Frederick was carried to Rock Island, Illinois, where Frederick Weyerhaeuser had his mill. And in those days, if timber broke loose and it got into somebody else's area, they just confiscated it, and for the most part, and the owner was never given anything for it. In this instance, Weyerhaeuser corralled the Ingram timber and went up to see Ingram and said, I got a lot of your logs down there, and I want to cut them, but I'll pay you a fair price for them, which was kind of unheard of, I guess. And so that developed a friendship that led to this merger. Well, Charlie Ingram was a descendant of those Ingrams.
Yeah.
And he had started out as timber cruising and that sort of thing when he first got out of university. So those people knew the woods, and they had a love of it. You could see it when you went out with them. They loved this timber. You know, they loved this land, and you could feel it.
Now, were you around when? Well, you were certainly around when Phil Weyerhaeuser suddenly died.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell me how people reacted to that and what their expectations were when that happened.
Well, of course, I mean, there was a great concern, and it felt like it was a great loss, because Phil was the kind of person that was, I think, very much loved by the people who worked around him and who knew him. But I don't think there was much concern about whether the company would abandon its thrust or would go to hell because of this, because they knew that there were other people to take over. And then what had happened, of course, is Frederick Weyerhaeuser became the new president. And I knew him, too. He was not as old shoe as Phil, well, I don't mean that, I guess. He was not quite as open and as, I guess you'd say, friendly as Phil was. I don't know, Phil had this way about him that, as I told you, he'd come down and sit by your desk and chat with you. And you know, I was a $450 a month guy. And here was the president coming down and sitting on the corner of my desk and saying, "Hi, how are things going? What are you doing?" And Frederick Weyerhaeuser wasn't that way. He was a little more aloof than Phil was. But I think it was a very smooth transition, and it led to the merger of Weyerhaeuser Sales Company with the timber company.
Was it a foregone conclusion that he would succeed? Or were there other contenders?
I really don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think it probably was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew Frederick Weyerhaeuser pretty well. I was invited to his house to play bridge and some things like that. And I think in those days I was probably kind of being groomed to take the top PR job. But things didn't work out quite that way.
Well, tell me how they did work out.
Well, one of the earliest things I did, we had a, in our department, the public information department then, there were about four of us, I think. And then secretaries, and one of the men was that we had in the department was a fellow named Albert Einst, who lives here in Portland now.
What was the last name again?
Einst, A-R-N-S-T. And Albert Einst was stationed here in Portland, and he did the lobbying at the Oregon Legislature. And also did much the same work that I did down in Washington, he did in Oregon. Outside of the lobbying, he did the same, pretty much the same thing that I did. If one of the branches had a problem and they needed somebody to help them, a public relations problem, he would do it, and then he wrote articles for the papers and all that sort of thing. Well, one of the earliest things we did was Weyerhaeuser had many years previously bought a large tract of timber from Pillsbury flower family, and that was at Coos Bay, and there was something like 250,000 acres, as I recall, and some of it was not Pillsbury land, but most of it was. Well, at any rate, Weyerhaeuser had never operated that. It was just virgin timber. So the company decided it was going to mill a mill, some mills at Coos Bay. And so they started doing this in about 1949, I think. And by 1951, they had already done some logging. 1951, the mill was done, and they were going to start it up. So Albert Arnst and I went down to Coos Bay, and we spent about a month down there, and we put out an entire edition almost of the North Bend News. And what it was, we had stories about the timber, we had stories about the mill, how it was built, who built it, and we had pictures of all of the foremen and all of the staff people above foremen, administrative people above foremen, a little story about each one, and the whole paper was about Weyerhaeuser. And the Coos Bay Times was the same way. We did a lot for them. I remember I went around taking pictures of all of the people that were going to operate the mill and the logging superintendent. And then we had pictures of the timberland. And we worked sometimes till 1 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, trying to get all this stuff written and put together. Then we had an open house. Arnst and I made all the preparations for this open house. And we invited the governor, the state forester, a lot of legislators. And Albert Arnst was a forester, and he laid out the tour on the tree farm. And it was a 60-mile tour over a dirt road. Because they hadn't yet got them surfaced. And it went through all this timber and up big steep hills and down steep hills. And here people came for this thing from all parts of the state, and legislators and people that hadn't been invited. We invited hundreds of people. And we first had place where we had barbecue lunch, and at Allegheny, which was the place where the logs would be put in the water and floated down to Coos Bay, and that was on the Coos River, and we had a ceremony there, and had all the people there who were top people in the company, and including the directors and president and chairman of the board. Chairman of the board at that time was Laird Bell, who was I think his mother was a Weyerhaeuser or something like that. But anyway, Laird Bell was a very, very prominent attorney in Chicago. And had been president, I think, of Boise Payette Lumber Company, too. well, he's on the board or chairman of the board or something like that. But anyway, all these people were there, and including the governor and a lot of legislators. And one of the speakers was Dr. Carl Schenck, who was the he was a German, S-C-H-E-N-K, who was a German who had started the Biltmore School of Forestry, which I think was the first school of forestry in the United States, but anyway, a renowned school of forestry. And I remember him making just a very stirring speech about farming the forest, you know, and he was just a really great speaker, and he really stirred the people. And he got about three-quarters of the way through his speech, and a golden eagle came over. And he said, "Bird up there, look down upon this forest." And it was marvelous. I mean, it was just as if it had been planned. And his comments about, "Look down upon this beautiful forest and bless it," you know. Oh, it was great.
Very rhetorical,
huh? Yes. And so then after this event, some people didn't want to go on the tour because they didn't want to drive their cars over these roads, you see. But a lot of people did go. And I suppose there were maybe 100 cars went or something like that. And Ernst had arranged for some trucks to come along behind in case some of these cars had any problem. Well, they had problems.
How did they?
Cars ran hot going up these hills, you know. Some couldn't make it. Oh, and I was riding in a... But it was a marvelous tour from the people who, you know, when they finally got through with it, because they saw virgin timber that a lot of them had never seen before. And it, I mean, this was a great forest, you know. And that forest down there, and that was, I think, like in June, and there was all these rhododendron, and some of the rhododendron was 15, 20 feet high, you know, underneath the old growth forest. It was beautiful. Well, I can remember I was riding in the seat with, or in the back seat of the car with the state forester. I can't remember his name now. Very well-known person, Oregon State. Or was he the head of the forestry department at Oregon State, I guess. I guess that's what it was, yeah. Head of the forestry department at Oregon State. And I can remember how irritated he got with Albert Ernst, because we were behind several cars, and the road had been sprinkled in the morning, but by that time it was dusty. And he was beating the dust off his hat, and it was hot. And he said, I thought that student of mine, Albert Ernst, had graduated in forestry, and he'd been one of this guy's students. He said, I taught that Albert Ernst better than this, and this is all he could do. He isn't a very good forester to plan a tour like this. But I think after he got through, he thought it was a pretty great tour. Well, that was one of the first things I did that first summer that I worked there.
Well, had you transferred down here physically? Or are you just working out of your home?
I was working out of my home. Well, I was working out of Tacoma at that time. But I went down to Coos Bay and stayed, you see, for about a month. Another thing that we had that first year was the 10th anniversary of the Clemens Tree Farm. And I, along with James Stevens from the West Coast Lumbermen's Association, planned that thing. And we went out, Jim Stevens and I went out and laid out the course, and then developed a little brochure which told everybody what they saw, different points. We had different points where they could stop. And then there along with the tour, there was a reception and a and at lunch, and this, and Governor Langley was a speaker, and this was at Montesano. And that turned out to be a very successful event, but I probably spent a month on that thing. And took a lot of pictures for it, and laid out the brochure for it, and wrote the brochures. And then another job that I did in those early days was we had laid out tours at all of our sawmills, but we needed a brochure to go along with it. And so I wrote and took the pictures for the brochures that went along with the tour. I don't know, I think somewhere you had a copy of one of those. Or maybe I have it here. No.
Okay, well, we can look for it.
But it was a little booklet. Uh-huh. And then we had laid out the tour, so there'd be a picture of what they saw, and then tell something about it and explain it, so that you didn't really have to have somebody do all this explaining in a noisy sawmill. They could take the brochure and then they could read that and then tell them what they saw. Well, can I stop for just a second? That, I'd like to say a little more about that 10th anniversary of the tree farm. You know, that reviewed the history of the tree farm movement. And it was widely publicized by the press, because the press turned out in some number for that. And of course, with the people like Governor Langley speaking and Phil Weyerhaeuser and others, it got some attention. I suppose some people don't know how that tree farm movement got started. But it was reviewed there. Phil Weyerhaeuser became concerned about this burning that was being done by people who had cattle, who had small farms around the Clemens Tree Farm. And this was an area that Weyerhaeuser was trying to rehabilitate. It had been burned repeatedly through the years. It had reforest, and then lightning had hit it or something, and they didn't have the fire protection that they had later, and all the young trees would get burned again, and so there was a lot of bare ground there, and what Weyerhaeuser was doing was getting rid of the brush and planting and trying to plant it and make it productive timberland. But these people who wanted this grazing land would just set fire to it every once in a while. So Phil Weyerhaeuser and some of the others, I don't know who he took with him, but they went down to Montesano and Aberdeen, and they talked to the newspaper editors down there about what they were trying to do. And they said, well, what can we do to make the people around here see that they shouldn't burn this, you know, that they ought to treat this like a farm, that they wouldn't go out and burn somebody's crop, but here they're burning this timber just like it doesn't amount to anything. So Chapin Collins, C-H-A-P-I-N-S, Chapin Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, was the publisher of the Montesano Gazette. And Collins suggested, why don't you call it a farm? Why don't you say this is a tree farm? And then we'll publicize it, and we'll have advertising and that sort of thing. You can use advertising to acquaint the people with what you're trying to do, and then call it a farm. And then maybe they won't burn like that. So Weyerhaeuser then did that. And this was highly publicized and was still being publicized. And this was about 1941. And was still being highly publicized when I came to the company in 1951. And that's why we had this 10th anniversary of the tree farm movement. Well, there was an organization called American Forest Products Industry that was set up as a result of this Weyerhaeuser starting this tree farm. Then Weyerhaeuser used its influence to get a national association which would be responsible for trying to get all timber owners, and small and large, to go together in a movement to have tree farms, and that would get public attention, and the public would treat them as farms and have some respect for them. So, before I came there, this association had been set up in Washington, D.C., called American Forest Products Industries, AFPI. And because Chapin Collins at the Mount of St. Vedette had had this insight to start this, make it a tree, call it a tree farm, and because he was such a believer in it and publicized it so much, they made him the head of AFPI.
Oh, my.
And so when by the time I came there, this organization was going well, and he came out for this dedication, of course, of the Clemens Tree Farm. And this, not the dedication, but the 10th anniversary of the dedication of the Clemens Tree Farm. And that brings me to this subject of the influence that Weyerhaeuser has had through the years nationally in determining the policies of the timber industry and the forestry industry, the policies and practices through the years. And Walter DeLong, I think, probably did this industry more good than any other single person, because he started so many public relations efforts in the industry, statewide, region-wide, nationally. I started them, but he was a prime mover in getting the industry to do more public relations-wise. And of course, behind that was the Weyerhaeuser executives. I mean, they believed in it, or he couldn't have done it.
So it had content to,
right,
besides just PR.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But Weyerhaeuser had been a leader in that all through the years. There isn't any question about it.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, there was an award for the kind of public relations material that was coming out for the tree farm, the paintings, and the national advertising.
Yeah, of course, that came along quite a bit later. But I think Walter DeLong was a tremendous influence in the industry, I worked with him, worked under him, and I knew him intimately. But behind that was the support of the Weyerhaeuser executives and the top people in Weyerhaeuser. And I think without the Weyerhaeuser influence, the industry would never be where it is today, public relations-wise. And it still has a lot of problems, I realize that. One of the contributions that I think I made was to, early in those early days, was to focus attention of the industry and Weyerhaeuser on the necessity of working more closely than in the past with the conservation organizations. You know, I think when I first came with Weyerhaeuser, the attitude of a lot of people in the timber industry was, well, those people are a bunch of kooks, you know, and leave them alone or don't say anything to them, or pay no attention to them. And AFPI began to pay some attention to them through the Outdoor Writers Association, and AFPI had a man here in Portland. They had regional PR people in various regions of the country, and one of them was Richard Gerhardt, G-E-A-R-H-A-R-T. He lives in Portland here now, and he was a graduate forester from Michigan, I think it was. But he saw, as I did, that if you never associated with people in the Isaac Walton League, people in the National Wildlife Federation, people in the Outdoor Writers Association, all you were doing was prolonging the ignorance that those people had of the industry. You were making your situation worse, not better. And that what you needed to do was to make an approach to those people and take them out and show them some things and point out to them where they might lack proper information. And also take note of some of the legitimate concerns that they had. And one of the things that I started, well, one of the issues that I started talking to Weyerhaeuser about and to the industry and to the AFPI people is that as our affluence grew, the concern was shifting away from economic concerns to quality of life concerns. And I was always trying to get Weyerhaeuser and the industry, and I didn't have much trouble with Weyerhaeuser in this respect, but getting the industry to take more note of the quality of life that people were demanding. Because when people started being concerned about air pollution, you know, the first reaction of a lot of people in the industry was, well, you know, what's the matter with these people? You know, they're way off in left field. And I can remember the Isaac Walton League here became first concerned, really concerned. Their first concern was water pollution and what was happening on forest land, that sort of thing. And they hadn't paid any attention to air pollution. And Dave Charlton, the Charlton Laboratories, was one of the first people that I ever heard in this community talk about the need for air pollution control. And he got the Isaac Walton League interested in it. And he got Dr. Alfred Kreft was in the Isaac Walton League. And he became concerned about it. And soon, this was a growing thing in the Isaac Walton League that we ought to be doing something about air pollution. And really, nothing ever, that was almost a voice in the wilderness until Weyerhaeuser built a Springfield plant.
Oh, that's a significant thing.
And when that plant came in, suddenly there was an interest in air pollution down at Eugene. But there was no interest in air pollution here in Portland at that time. Except that Kraft and Charlton and a few other people in the Isaac Walton League began talking it up. And eventually it became an issue. And what I was trying to do in those days was to try to make the industry anticipate and look ahead and say, well, and take note of the fact that people were becoming more concerned about the quality of life, which meant that they were becoming concerned about air pollution, they were becoming concerned about pesticides, and that we should get out there and not react to some crisis that came along in air pollution or water pollution or the use of pesticides, but we ought to be doing something ahead of time to alleviate these problems. I'm not sure that I made any big splash, but I...